It is now 13 hours, Greenwich Mean Time.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting from Washington.
Here is the news. Warren Shear reporting.
Within the hour, America's Apollo 15 astronauts Scott, Irwin, and Worden will blast off from Cape Kennedy for a 12-day expedition to the moon. They are now in their spaceship cabin atop the huge Saturn V rocket. The weather is good, and everything indicates that the launch will take place right on time. As the liftoff time neared, hundreds of thousands of persons jammed vantage points to watch the start of one of the most ambitious scientific expeditions ever mounted. Mission Commander Scott and his colleague, Lieutenant Colonel Irwin, will make three long excursions outside their craft, probing the area around the foot of the towering Apennine Mountains, the highest peaks on the moon, and the mysterious Hadley Rill, a winding gorge which most scientists believe was formed by flowing lava that poured out of sublunar volcanoes north of the landing site and then dried up. The crevasse is about 1.5 kilometers wide and 400 meters deep. This is the landing site between the high mountain peaks and the rill in a place called the Marsh of Decay. The astronauts will cover some 35 kilometers of lunar terrain in their excursions. Their range extended considerably from previous Apollo missions by a four-wheeled, electrically driven vehicle called a lunar rover. Television cameras mounted on the car will transmit what are expected to be the most spectacular moon pictures yet sent back to Earth, including, for the first time, a lunar liftoff. The number of American forces in Vietnam dropped to the lowest level since December 1965. The United States Command in Saigon said the number now stands at 229,200. In military action, B-52 bombers struck North Vietnamese troop concentrations, anti-aircraft emplacements, and bunkers near Fire Base Fuller, near the demilitarized zone, in an area where South Vietnamese forces found a large communist ammunition cache. The raid followed two other strikes Sunday in other areas of South Vietnam's northernmost province, Quang Tri. Former South Vietnamese Chief of State General Duong Van Minh has officially announced he will run for president in the presidential election next October. General Minh, a Southern Buddhist, named 35-year-old Ho Van Minh, the deputy speaker of the lower house and a Catholic, as his running mate. Last week, President Nguyen Van Thieu formally announced he will seek a second four-year term. The third announced presidential candidate is Vice President Nguyen Cao Ky. The presidential hopefuls have 10 days to register their candidacy officially with the South Vietnamese Supreme Court. In making his announcement, General Minh said that if he saw the elections are not honest, he would ask the people to permit him to withdraw from the race. Sudanese authorities have arrested Communist Party leader Abdelkhalek Makhdjoub and said he will face trial on charges of being a mastermind behind the short-lived coup last week against President Jafar Numeri. Dispatches say the roundup of persons believed implicated in the coup continues. A military tribunal is reported continuing trial of Colonel Babacar Nour, who last week was named Sudan's new ruler while he was in London. His top aide, Major Farouk Hamadala, was said yesterday to have been shot by a firing squad after a military trial. But there are now reports that he has not yet been executed. 8 other officers have been executed. Dispatches from Calcutta say that East Pakistanis continue to flee into India at the rate of between 40,000 and 50,000 persons a day. They say this brings the total to more than 7 million arrivals in 4 months, and that deaths from malnutrition are mounting. Delhi Radio says the Pakistani army has had to reimpose a curfew in several places in the Sylhet area of East Pakistan because of an increase in guerrilla activities. Vice President Spiro Agnew arrived in Lisbon, the last stop of his world trip on behalf of President Nixon. Mr. Agnew's two-day schedule in Portugal includes talks with Premier Marcelo Caetano and other senior officials. Our correspondent, William McCrory, says NATO defense, especially in the Mediterranean area, is expected to be the major topic. The conferees also may discuss some of Portugal's economic and political problems. Syria announced that it is closing its border with Jordan. The Syrian government said the move is in protest against Jordan's attacks on the Palestinian guerrillas and the alleged shelling of Syrian border villages. Syria is the second Arab country to close its borders with Jordan. The first was Iraq, which has also recalled its ambassador. Meanwhile, the Israeli cabinet met to prepare for the visit of Assistant Secretary of State Joseph Sisko and to hear an analysis of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat's Friday speech. The Egyptian leader said the Middle East conflict should be settled by the end of the year, either by peaceful means or by renewed warfare. President Sadat is scheduled to speak again today to the closing session of the Arab Socialist Union's National Congress. An Israeli military spokesman said 5 Arab guerrillas were killed by an Israeli patrol in a clash in the occupied Gaza Strip. No Israeli casualties were reported. American writer Edgar Snow, who has known communist Chinese leaders Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai for about 40 years, says he believes President Nixon's plans to visit Peking might have already prompted secret talks between nationalist and mainland China. In a Life magazine article, Mr. Snow said the two Chinas may be able to proceed with reunification talks if the United States and communist China settle their differences on the status of Taiwan. In Peking, Vice Premier Li Qianyin vigorously restated his government's stand that Taiwan is an inseparable part of mainland China and must be liberated. Meanwhile, Taiwan's ambassador to Washington, James Shen, reiterated Sunday that his government will not share United Nations membership with the People's Republic. He said if member nations are concerned with the UN Charter's legality, there can be no doubt that his government will retain its seat. Typhoon Nadine, with winds of over 200 kilometers per hour, is moving toward communist China today after cutting through the northern Philippines and Taiwan. Filipino authorities say the storm killed at least 9 persons. And the nationalist Chinese Central News Agency said Nadine struck Taiwan Sunday, killing 7 and injuring 27. In Belfast, Northern Ireland, 9 policemen were injured when hundreds of soccer fans leaving a game pelted them with stones. Also in Belfast, a British Army patrol broke up a game of soccer being played by children after their ball was discovered to be a live nail bomb. No one was injured. In Lurgan, crowds gathered for the third straight night, and British troops were the target of gasoline and nail bomb attacks. One car was set on fire. No injuries were reported. Here again are the major stories at this hour. Apollo 15 is set to blast off for the moon within the hour. Dispatches from Calcutta say East Pakistanis continue to flee to India. In the Sudan, authorities have arrested a Communist Party leader and charged him with masterminding last week's short-lived coup. And former South Vietnamese Chief of State General Duong Van Minh announced he will run for president next October. That's the news, Warren Shear reporting.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting worldwide. Apollo 15 is now in the final stages of countdown. Standing by at the Kennedy Space Center is VOA's Rhett Turner, who has this report on preparations for the moon mission.
Mission Director Chester Lee said all we have to do for a perfect on-time launch is to outwit the weather. Well, it looks like that either the gods were with us, or the weatherman was with us, or the flight controllers and engineers did the right thing, because the day couldn't be more gorgeous. It's a perfect day for an on-time launch, and all of the complex systems on the big Saturn rocket towering there 107 meters above the launch pad, everything is ready. The countdown clock says 23 minutes right now, 23 minutes 58 seconds until liftoff, and we hope all of you will be tuned in with us when that rocket roars off the pad and Dave Scott, Al Worden, and Jim Irwin are on their way to the moon. There are billowing clouds of liquid oxygen as the 250,000 gallons of fuel pressurizes in this big rocket. And as the pressure builds up and this super cold fuel warms just slightly, some of it has to be blown off the side, and it comes off in great billowing white clouds of what appears to be smoke. But that really is just liquid oxygen coming out of the side of the top of the first stage of the Saturn rocket. Inside, the three astronauts are going through their checklist, the most important of which is a space vehicle emergency detection. They've checked out all the communications. We've been listening to the voice of launch control, Jack King, whom you will hear counting down the final seconds of launch, give us status every few minutes as the astronauts are going through that checkoff list. The temperature is 83 degrees Fahrenheit. We have 10-mile-per-hour winds from the southeast. This is perfect for a launch. You couldn't ask for better weather. And I believe that we're going to have one of the largest crowds ever here in the Cape Kennedy area to watch this. It's summertime, vacation time for Americans. And also, this is the last one of the Apollo missions, which will come during the vacation period. So there well may be over 1 million people, families particularly, mothers and fathers and their children, lining the sands and the roads and the causeways in this lovely Atlantic beach coastal area, watching this liftoff just 21 minutes now away. This is Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy. We'll be back with more at 9:30.
In Washington, the Republic of China's ambassador to the United States, James Shen, discussed his government's attitude toward President Nixon's planned trip to Peking in an interview for the American Broadcasting Company.
Ambassador Shen, you have described the Kissinger visit to Peking and the lack of prior consultation with Taipei as a shabby deal.
Yes, I
and
did.
And no way to treat a friend. Well, after conferring with Secretary Rogers and others here in Washington, do you hold to that opinion, sir?
I still do.
Then is there any chance that you can hope for a realistic dialogue or influence in Washington to influence its relations with Peking? Do you fear what I'm asking you is a secret deal in Peking?
We've been told there has been no secret deal. And I hope that is true.
Well, have you been given sufficient assurances that there will be no secret deal in Peking as far as Nationalist China is concerned?
Yes, we have received such assurances.
Then could I ask you, sir, would Taipei, in your opinion, accept the philosophy or the claim, possibly, that the United States could fulfill its treaty obligations without maintaining presence of American troops on Formosa?
That's a highly technical question. Off the cuff, I cannot see how you can really fulfill your treaty commitment without having something there to make it real. To the potential enemy.
Can Taipei go it alone if it proves necessary? Are you self-sustaining?
It's not a question of whether we can or cannot. It's a question of whether we must or mustn't.
Mr. Ambassador, there seems to be a growing feeling in this country that the United States can no longer support Taipei's claim to be the sole legitimate government of all China. Do you think that your government will ever accept that notion?
I doubt that very much, because that has been our position. That is the raison d'etre of our whole policy since we left the Chinese mainland. Our hope and plan is to be able to restore freedom to all our compatriots on the Chinese mainland, whom we really think we still represent.
Mr. Ambassador, under any circumstances whatsoever, can you see Peking and Taiwan sharing seats in the United Nations?
I do not at the moment.
Under no circumstances?
No.
Well, then that does, in effect, answer what your response is going to be, does it not, at the United Nations? If you cannot share membership with the...
That has been our position. It's our basic position that the Chinese Communists do not represent the people.
Can you again, given all of the facts that we now know, can you muster the support to retain your seat and to bar mainland China this year?
You know, it's a...
You must have a nose count.
Oh, yes, we do. We hope and we believe there will still be enough members in the UN who care enough about the Charter and its legality to refuse to see us expelled.
Ambassador Shent, I gather from all of this, from what we have said so far, that you're not at all convinced that anything at all concrete and important is going to come out of this summit conference. Is this a fair reflection of the impression that you're giving me?
That's right. I think it's quite accurate.
Then you're not really concerned about what actually might be taking place in some future closed-door meeting with Zhou Enlai and President Richard Nixon.
But the very fact that your president promised to go...
Do you consider that de facto recognition?
That's already, I won't say that, but that's already, insofar as countries in my part of the world are concerned, it's something that's done. The effect's already been felt. Doubts are being aroused.
Well, one of the fears that has often been expressed by Asian countries is a fear of Japan. What is this new American policy, in your opinion and your experience, going to prop Japan to do? Will they become more militaristic? Will they develop nuclear weapons? How is this going to affect the Japanese position?
That's anybody's guess, but so we can see already that... Mr. Nixon's announcement has brought on a near crisis in the Japanese cabinet itself, making Mr. Sato's position increasingly difficult. Whether or not Japan will rearm in earnest, it's still too early to say. But the feeling probably in the back of some people's head in Japan is if USA could do this too, then Republic of China, one of the older friends, and because of whom USA went to war in the Pacific. Now, who can tell that similar things would not be done to other former allies, friends of your country? And Japan is an ex-enemy.
Have we raised that suspicion among our Asian allies that we cannot be trusted now?
I am afraid that feeling is spreading.
Ambassador James Shen of the Republic of China. The first ambassador to Canada from the People's Republic of China has arrived in Ottawa to assume his new post. Columbia Broadcasting System's Alan Jackson looks at the man and his mission.
He is 60-year-old Wang Hua, a veteran Chinese diplomat with impressive credentials. One indication of his ranking in Peking is that he is late arriving for his assignment in Ottawa, 7 weeks late according to the latest schedule. But Wang Hua had an intermediate assignment. He was a key figure in the recent surprise Peking visit of President Nixon's emissary, Henry Kissinger. Apparently involved in arranging that visit, he was on hand to greet Kissinger when he arrived and was one of the top officials besides Zhou Enlai to confer with Kissinger during that crowded weekend. Wang Hua earned a reputation as a tough negotiator during the Panmunjom-Korean War talks. Later, he served as chief aide to Zhou Enlai at the 1954 Geneva Conference. More recently, Wang Hua was the principal Peking representative in Africa and the Middle East during the 60s. First in Ghana, when the Chinese Communists were giving substantial aid to its former flamboyant president Kwame Nkrumah, and then later in Cairo, from where he directed Chinese Communist affairs in both Arab and African areas. And it's worth pointing out that Wang Hua was one of the few senior Chinese diplomats who was not recalled to Peking for re-education during Mao Zedong's chaotic Cultural Revolution. Thus the background, the credentials of mainland China's first ambassador to the Western Hemisphere in 22 years. He speaks English fluently, and although he has never visited the United States, he is said to be quite knowledgeable about the U.S. His new post in Ottawa, therefore, is expected to serve as a principal bridge not only to Canada, but to the U.S. and to the U.N., as Red China puts on its own new-look approach to the West. There is, of course, a certain amount of trade between Canada and the Chinese mainland, but a diplomat of Huang's stature is not needed to supervise that. And at best, the amount of trade and travel China can expect from Canada, a nation of only 21 million, will be limited. The Chinese, therefore, must expect other, more substantial benefits to derive from the fact that they have an active, top-level embassy staff only 60 miles from the U.S. border. More importantly, that new embassy staff is only a few blocks away from the large U.S. embassy in Ottawa, which will be able to deal directly with the Chinese delegation without going through Canada or other intermediaries. Alan Jackson, CBS News.
American Army Captain Ernest Medina goes on trial today for the murder of Vietnamese civilians at My Lai in March 1968. From Fort McPherson, Georgia, Bruce Morton of the Columbia Broadcasting System has this background report on the trial procedure.
Military law requires at least a five-man jury. For a long trial, that always means at least six in case somebody gets sick. As in civilian trials, lawyers for prosecution and defense can question prospective jurors, and the questioning always says something about the kind of case the lawyers plan to try. Medina's lawyer, F. Lee Bailey, has already said he hopes the panel will include some younger officers, men who, like Medina, have commanded companies in Vietnam. Bailey wants that probably because command, the responsibility of command, will be a major issue in this trial. The Army concedes that Medina, unlike his platoon leader, William Calley, was not directly involved in the massacre. The Army concedes it may not be able to prove that Medina ever ordered a massacre in so many words. But the Army says he was there at My Lai that day. He was in command. He let it happen. Pretrial publicity is another factor in jury picking. A lot of officers may have made up their minds by now. Nobody knows how long it will take to pick a jury panel. As in civilian courts, the lawyers can ask a judge to disqualify a prospective juror for cause, that is, to bar him on this or that ground. They don't have as many arbitrary challenges as civilian courts allow. And there is another factor. Any officer asked to judge Medina may remember what happened to the six men who judged William Calley. Abusive telephone calls and letters, threats against their wives and children. It's not a job very many officers would want. Bruce Morton, CBS News, Fort McPherson, Georgia.
In the Sudan, trials are continuing for those involved in last week's rebellion against President Jafar Numeri. David Roberts reports.
The latest prominent figure to be arrested in Khartoum is Abdul Khalik Mahjoub, the Secretary General of the Sudanese Communist Party. Radio Amdurman announced his apprehension and arrest on Monday. According to Sudanese Minister Mohamed Idris, commenting in Khartoum on Sunday, Mr. Mahjoub was the brains behind the abortive coup against General Numeri's government. Minister Idris also said that as many as 1,000 people are now under arrest in the Sudan, although General Numeri himself this past weekend in an interview put the number at 400. Eight officers involved in the three-day rebellion reportedly have been tried and executed, among them the man who staged the coup, Major Hashem al-Atta, and one of two officers detained and then sent to Khartoum by Libyan authorities, former Interior Minister Major Farouk Hamadullah, although a Monday conflicting report from Khartoum said Major Hamadullah was still alive. The second officer detained and then sent to the Sudan by Libya, Lieutenant Colonel Babakar Anour, named Sudan's new ruler at the height of the leftist insurgency, reportedly has been sentenced to death, but punishment was delayed pending hearing of a special witness. David Roberts, Voice of America, Middle East Bureau.
Stay tuned now for VOA coverage of the launch of Apollo 15.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting worldwide, the flight of Apollo 15, man's fourth visit to the lunar surface. The 12-day mission, the most ambitious yet, will be carried out by Commander David R. Scott. Command Module Pilot Alfred Worden and Lunar Module Pilot James B. Irwin. Liftoff is scheduled for about 9 minutes from now at 13 hours 34 GMT. We take you now to Cape Kennedy for VOA correspondent Rhett Turner's description of the Apollo 15 launch.
Well, we're waiting for the last 8 minutes and 20 seconds of the countdown to tick off, and everything is ready out there on launch pad number 39A. Here on the sands of Cape Kennedy, there are several hundred newsmen working. There are typewriters clicking, TV cameras aimed at the launch pad, full color of this launch going around the world. Still photographers in a great bleacher section with telephoto lenses, 400 and 500 millimeter lenses aimed out across the launch pad, toward the launch pad, 5 kilometers away from us. They say that that's the safe distance for us to back off from the launch pad itself when one of these Saturn V rockets lift off. 7.5 million pounds of thrust will be exerted at liftoff to push this immense amount of weight up toward orbit of the Earth. Then 2.5 hours after liftoff, while in Earth orbit down over Australia, the third stage rocket section of the booster is to be fired, sending Apollo 15 toward the moon and about a three-day coast to the moon. With me is NASA engineer Don Beatty, who's been with us many times before on our broadcast. Don, welcome to this one at the Cape. This is the first time you've sat with us on a launch, isn't it?
That's right, Rhett. Normally I've been with you during the mission to explain some of the things that were going on.
Now, Don has specialized in direct support to the mission planning this time on the lunar science and lunar surface activities, haven't you?
That's correct, Rhett.
What most impresses you, Don, about the things the fellows will be doing on the surface this time? What's the single most important thing you believe that may be accomplished?
Well, this mission, of course, we have the lunar rover vehicle with us, and we'll be traveling many kilometers away from the LEM for the first time. On the 14 mission, we went just a little over a kilometer or so from the LEM, but this time we'll be going perhaps 8 or so kilometers from the LEM, traveling along the front and looking at the geology.
The front, the escarpment of the lunar Apennine Mountains.
That's right.
The geology is really expected to be the most interesting and scientifically rewarding part, isn't it?
Well, this is a fantastic site. We have the mountains, and we have a rill, and we have the mare, so we have a great many objectives to look at on this mission.
And possibly even a volcanic crater?
To the north, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then in lunar orbit, Al Worden will be extremely busy with more sensors and exotic photographic equipment than we've ever had before, won't he?
That's right. We have over 1,000 pounds of new scientific equipment in the command and service module on this mission.
Do I hear Jack King? Let's go to mission control.
So Falcon and the rover are go. Dave Scott thanked him for this and then also received a report from spacecraft test conductor Skip Chauvin that the command ship, which will be have the call sign Endeavour, also is go. We've just completed our status reports, and the launch operations manager, Paul Donnelly, the launch director, Walt Caprian, and the mission director, Chet Lee, all have given their goes. We're standing by for the swing arm to retract to its full fallback position. It's moving now as we approach the five-minute mark in the count.
That's
coming
Jack
on the
King.
Five-minute mark. Mark, T-minus 5 minutes and counting. We're go on Apollo 15. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
That's Jack King in the Launch Control Center, the voice I believe I mentioned to you earlier. We would hear making that final 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0 countdown. The rocket actually lights a few seconds before zero. During that 10-second countdown, during the last 10 seconds, there is a period. Ignition is 8.9 seconds before actual liftoff, or T0. And when you hear the firing control say 10, 9, between 9 and 8, we should be able to see flame come out the bottom of this gigantic rocket. And then as the engines build up their thrust, the latches are released at T0. When the count gets to zero, and at that point, 7.5 million pounds of thrust should be exerting, lifting the rocket off the launch pad. Now, before it clears the support tower, it will seem to tilt slightly away from that tower, toward the east or toward the right, if you happen to be looking at television or from our launch vantage point here. And this is to assure tower clearance. A lot of times some people watching may hold their breath. They think it's going to tip over. But this slight tilt away, here's launch control again.
The terminal sequencer has been armed and we are go. Launch operations manager Paul Donnelly just wished the crew good luck and Godspeed and received an expression of thanks from all three crew members. We'll be coming up shortly on the automatic sequence. 3 minutes, 10 seconds, firing command enable. Firing command on. We have the firing command. We're now on the automatic sequence, and the tanks in the three stages of the Saturn V that contain those propellants will begin to pressurize. The countdown is still proceeding, and we're at now two minutes, 50 seconds, and counting. We understand there is an estimate that there are more than a million people in the area here to view the launch. The traffic has been heavy since 2 o'clock this morning. The beaches are packed and the roads are packed. 2 minutes, 35 seconds, and counting. We're monitoring our status board here in firing room one. Our ready lights are on, concerned with spacecraft, emergency detection system, instrument unit. Our preparations are complete, and the automatic sequence is continuing. 2 minutes, 20 seconds, and counting.
That's launch control, Jack King, explaining this last-minute countdown procedure. Liquid oxygen is billowing out of the top of the pressurized vehicles, the top of the S1 stage, the first stage. T-minus 2 minutes and counting right now. Let's listen to the voice of launch control, Jack King.
The crew here in the firing room monitoring more than 300 red line values, watching temperatures and pressures to ensure they do not go above nominal. In the case that it did, any one of these key people could call in to hold the countdown. 1 minute, 36 seconds, and counting, still going well. The pressurization sequence is still continuing in the vehicle. We're now 90 seconds away from liftoff, all still going well. We'll go on internal...
The weather is perfect here at the Cape. It's we were worried about it up until now. There were thunder showers in the area up until last night. They've cleared. It's a very hot, sunny day here at the Cape with high cirrus clouds. We're going to be able to see the rocket perfectly.
Second stage tanks are pressurized as our countdown continues. Mark, T-minus 60 seconds and counting on...
The smoke has stopped billowing out of the S1C engine stage. That means that the pressure will build up. There is no more of the liquid oxygen billowing off.
Power transfer. The vehicle now on the battery power on the vehicle, and all is still going well. Lunar Module Pilot Jim Irwin making some final checks, now passing the 40-second mark. Spacecraft Commander Dave Scott now has made his final check. That is aligning the guidance system. 30 seconds and counting. The guidance system will go internal at the 17-second mark. Now 25 seconds. We have complete clearance to launch. We are go.
Everything's 20. Automatic now.
15 seconds, guidance internal, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start, engines armed, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, all engines running.
It's beautiful, the fire's billowing out.
We have liftoff at 9:34 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Rocket's tilting, passing the tower, tower is clear.
The tower is clear.
Here and comes the roll program.
Roger. You have good thrust on all five engines.
Same sort of. Roll complete.
Roger.
And we have a pitch program.
Roger, pitch.
Can you hear the astronaut?
Stand by for mode 1 Bravo. Mark 1 Bravo.
Roger, 1 Bravo.
Booster Systems Engineer reports to Flight Director that S1C stage
looks good, they
good.
Say. It's now several thousand feet into the air.
15 Houston, everything looks perfect down here.
Okay, Houston. Looks smooth up here, Toto.
Dave Scott said it looks good up here. Houston says it looks perfect. Now it's beginning to pitch over to the east. Several kilometers into the air now. It's hitting the stratosphere, and we're seeing the contrail, white smoke contrail
going
of the rocket.
Maximum dynamic pressure at this time.
That's the voice of Mission Control in Houston now. We can see this one beautifully today. It's going up into through those high cirrus clouds, aiming out over the Atlantic Ocean. It's through the moisture of the stratosphere now, no longer a contrail, just a great billow of white smoke it leaves in its wake. Oh, what a beautiful sight. I don't believe we've ever had a more...
9 miles downrange, 14.5 miles height.
Charlie?
You heard Mission Control.
Mark 1 Charlie now.
Roger, 1 Charlie.
Giving you the readout.
Each of the S1Cs.
Roger.
Another great contrail of smoke.
Each of the five S1C engines gulping 3 tons of fuel per second.
3 tons of fuel per second
airport.
Being swallowed up
Roger,
and burned.
Airport.
It's going right by the sun from our viewpoint here. We'll have to shield our eyes to see the spacecraft as it passes by the sun. That has a symbolic meaning, I suppose.
Flight dynamics reports go for staging.
Apollo 15 is passing the sun from our vantage point at the launch site. Someday, man may go there in a protective cover and look at the origins of our universe. We can still see it. The S1C stage is burning beautifully.
Good thrust on the S2. All five are good.
Okay.
Good thrust on the S2. That means we've got staging. The second stage is cut in now.
47.9 altitude.
Those primary engines burned for a little over 2.5 minutes. Now we're up to 3 minutes and 13 seconds.
Roger, we confirm the skirt set. You're mode 2.
Roger, mode 2.
All right, there now. The launch escape tower should have jettisoned by now.
Jettison issue.
Roger.
That was Dave Scott, the sort of strong but muffled-sounding voice reporting back to Mission Control in Houston. You're hearing these voices live as the astronauts go into orbit. Let's see, Don, I looked down at my chart and I lost. Can you still see the bird up there?
I'm coming up on 10,000 feet per second mark. Downrange 131, altitude 66.
66 nautical miles above the Earth. That's almost 100 kilometers above the Earth now.
15 Houston at 4. The guidance has converged. The
it's out of sight.
Go. Everything looks good.
Okay, go ahead. Looks good up here.
I can't recall having been able to see
35% of the velocity needed to
rocket
orbit.
So long after launch, such clear weather. We've had clouds on so many of our launches, haven't we, Don?
Yes, that was a perfect launch. We could see the cutoff of the S1 and then the staging very clearly today.
That's when the smoke ended, then there was a period of post.
Miles,
and then the
altitude 79.
Right.
Altitude 79 nautical miles above the Earth. Now, the engines will burn now on the S2 stage for about 9 minutes. 9 minutes and 9 seconds. We have now burned for 4 minutes, 47 seconds since liftoff. So several more minutes to go on the second stage rocket engines. Now, on Apollo 14, one of the, as I recall, of the five engines, the inner engine shut off early. And the outside engines burned longer to compensate for it. That, in other words, there's plenty of safety margin. 40% of velocity needed, says Mission Control.
Downrange 271, altitude 88.
88 nautical miles above the Earth. The great billow of smoke from the launch pad has now gone up into the sky several thousand feet, and it's just forming one more of the many clouds which build up here around the Cape during the summertime.
Predicting nominal shutdown on the S2 stage.
Sim times are nominal. A level sensor arm will be 8 plus 3, 4, and S2 cutoff at 9 plus 0, 9. Over.
Roger, 8 plus 3, 4, and 9 plus 0, 9.
That's 9 minutes and 9 seconds.
Stand by for S4B to COI. Mark, you have S4B to COI now.
Roger, S4B to COI.
The engines are predicted to shut down right on time, 9 minutes and 9 seconds after liftoff. You heard Mission Control telling Dave Scott.
380
you heard
miles downrange, altitude 94.5.
94.5.
Velocity 15,000 feet per second.
really moving now. They've got to get up to 25,000 feet per second to be into orbital velocity. Great clouds of water are spraying across the launch support structure out there on the pad. As soon as the rocket lifts off, tons and tons of water are sprayed all over the launch pad and the launch bucket area to protect
it. Mark, you have it now. Mark, just orbit.
We can see the clouds of water spraying off of the launch support structure. Some of that may be smoke from a little burning, too.
Downrange 479, altitude 96. Now approaching 65% of velocity needed for orbit. Velocity now 16,700 feet per second.
They're in their orbital altitude.
Liftoff 34 minutes, 00 seconds, 0.79.
They have reached the orbital altitude, but haven't reached the orbital speed yet. Still about two more minutes to go. 7 minutes, 22 seconds since liftoff. They're shooting for a 90 nautical mile orbit this time, a little lower than before to save fuel so they can carry more weight to the moon. They've gained some 5,000 pounds in payload capacity by trimming here and there in their trajectory. Don, I've heard a couple of different figures. I've heard 5,000 pounds, and I've heard 2,000. Do you? It's several thousand pounds, I'm sure.
Yes, it's about 5,000 pounds this time to make up for the added weight of the LEM and the extra payload we're carrying.
All right, the lunar rover, all the scientific instruments.
Altitude 95 miles.
95 miles. It's come down 1 mile.
Velocity required for orbit.
In other words, it's really leveling off. Well, they're getting a little. That was Dave Scott.
You've had PO shift, and the thrust looks good.
Okay.
That's Dave Scott saying, Houston, did you call? Do you want something? The communication is coming in clearer now that they're up at greater altitudes.
Roger.
Also, these tracking dishes can zero in a little better when you give them a minute or two after liftoff. We're getting a good breeze here. It's quite hot here at Cape Kennedy, some 83 to 85 degrees with a bright, almost tropical sunshine. And now we've got a little breeze cooling us, and that is very welcome at this point.
About 6 seconds to staging.
Here we go. 6 seconds to staging. Engine shutdown right now.
Stand by for mode 4 capability. Mark, you have mode 4 now.
Roger, a good staging.
Dave Scott confirmed a good staging. That was his voice.
Booster reports thrust okay on the S-4B stage.
You have good thrust on the S-4B.
Now the third stage rocket is burning. It still has to go for another, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 minutes. We go up to about 11 minutes, 38 seconds.
7 altitude, velocity 23,230.
About another 2,000 feet per second and about another 2 minutes of burn time on this third stage rocket to achieve orbital velocity. They have leveled off in the orbital altitude desired, some 95 nautical miles above the Earth, by reducing the orbital altitude to approximately 90 miles, what is generally called a 90-mile orbit, and by refining the launch azimuth, making it having a little broader range within which they could launch, they gain some of this extra weight, which may be carried as payload to the moon. Everything is nominal, as the spacemen say. That's one word I almost wish they'd change, Don. I hear the word nominal so much. However, I'm happy to hear what it means. Normal, right on schedule, on the mark, other such things. All of you in NASA, all of you engineers, you're very happy with that one anytime you hear it, aren't you?
That's a good word to hear.
Perfect. Predicted cutoff time, 11 plus 37. Over.
Roger, 11 plus 37.
That means 11 minutes, 37 seconds. Cutoff is predicted. Mission Control telling Dave Scott that, and you heard his voice as he acknowledged. They're way down out over the Atlantic now, headed out toward the Canary Islands.
181 miles downrange, 93.4 altitude, 97% of velocity, 98% of velocity required. 25,143 feet per second.
You'll notice that they went up to about 96 miles above the Earth, and as they pick up speed, they're drifting down slightly, a little lower. This leveling off is also bringing them down 2 or 3 nautical miles, now down to 93 nautical miles above the Earth. 1-1 plus 3-4, that was a confirmation of the time of cutoff, 3 seconds early from Dave Scott.
Booster confirms the S-4B has shut down.
Booster confirms it. You heard Dave Scott also saying it.
Gimbal motors are off, and the S-4B oxidizer is 4-0, and the fuel is about 3-1.
Just 4-0 and 3-1.
There was one of the astronauts, I think that was Irwin, reading off the...
93.7 by 88.9, shut down on a VI of plus 25595, H-dot plus 00008. Altitude plus 00932.
That was Al Worden, the navigator.
Roger, copy.
You heard Jim Irwin read off the fuel parameters, and then Al Worden read off the navigation parameters from their onboard calculations, 93.2 nautical miles above the Earth, according to the onboard readings on Apollo 15 in the Falcon spaceship. Well, you couldn't ask for a better one, could you, Don? That was a beautiful launch.
IU shows you in a 92.5 by 91.5. Radar confirms that, and the booster is saved.
Okay, Gordo, good job. That was a very smooth ride all the way.
That was Dave Scott saying, good job, a very smooth ride all the way. David Scott confirmed. You can probably hear his voice plainer than mine. It's very clear, isn't it? They're in orbit now. 13 minutes since liftoff from here at the Cape. 13 minutes, 15 seconds right now. The S-4B, the third stage, will have to work for them again because at 2.5 hours into the mission, it'll be fired as the spacecraft orbits down across the South Pacific. And
15 Houston, the booster is configured for orbit, over.
Roger.
Mission Control says the booster is configured for orbit. Dave Scott acknowledges. Roger. The astronauts are in orbit around the Earth at this point. Well, Don Beatty, I would like for you to tell me now, review for me, would you, the major objectives, the science that's to be achieved or attempted, certainly the ambitious undertaking on the lunar surface. This is something you've concentrated on throughout mission planning up to now.
Well, this mission, Rhett, we expect to get back as much scientific data as all of the other missions combined. This mission is going to last quite a bit longer. We're going to be on the lunar surface for 3 full days, and the objectives of the mission are very ambitious. The site itself is an extremely interesting site, and as you know, the choice of this site was predicated upon a number of scientific objectives.
Who helped pick out the site? What kind of inputs or voices were heard from geologists, from scientists around the world?
Well, for many months before the selection of the site, we had a number of scientists from all over the United States advising us on what they thought were the appropriate objectives of the mission. We had a number of committees that meet, and then finally we make our recommendations to Dr. Rocco Patrone, the Apollo program manager, and he finally okays the selection.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of candidate sites in the running right up to the very end, and finally Hadley Apennine was selected.
Let's describe for our listeners what the Hadley Apennine region looks like. First of all, how was this Apennine ridge of mountains formed, that Mare Imbrium event? Go back to that for me.
Well, the landing site is on the eastern edge of the right eye of the moon. It's the Mare Imbrium, and the mountain range was formed, is believed to have formed, by the impact of a small moon early in the developmental history of the moon itself.
If our listeners have a map of the moon, it's about 26 degrees north and just barely west of the north-south zero longitude line, isn't it?
Yes, it's we're landing 3 degrees east of the central meridian of the moon.
And then 26 degrees north.
Yes,
okay, continue.
That's right. Now, the landing site is characterized by these very high Apennine Mountains on the eastern side of the landing site, and they swing around down to the south. And Hadley Mountain, it will be east of the landing site, and then a mountain that the astronauts will refer to many times during the mission, I'm sure, Hadley Delta, is to the south. Mm-hmm. And these mountains range from approximately 11,000 feet to 14 or 15,000 feet above the landing site.
That's almost 5,000 meters up into the blackness of the sky from the surface. Now, the mountains are believed to have been formed by this cratering event. In other words, it pushed up some of the deep-seated, the deepest parts of the moon, didn't it?
Yes, the theory is that when this small moon impacted onto the larger moon, it ejected a large amount of material from the original crust of the moon and formed the mountains.
And that crust is believed to go back some 4,500,000 years, 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years, some of the original material of the moon itself.
And so that is the primary reason for going to this site.
That is the prime objective, to sample that early material. And it comes as a logical extension of the Apollo 14 mission, where we were hoping to get some of the ejected material from Mare Imbrium further to the south.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how the rill was formed? Does anyone?
Well, the rills are very interesting features on the moon. There are a number of different kinds of rills. There are straight rills, and there are sinuous rills, and there are shallow rills and deep rills. And the origin is a subject of great scientific controversy at this time. Some people believe that they were formed by water eroding out the surface of the moon. Other people believe that it could be a collapsed lava tube, a tube that forms when there are volcanic eruptions, and the lava pours through a small tunnel, and then subsequently the top of the tunnel collapses. Other people believe that these are faults, tensional fractures in the surface of the moon, which separate and cause the rill to fall down.
There's some dark mare material from the Pallas Putridinus.
Yes.
This putrid marsh, if we translate it into English.
This is probably one of the younger mare that we'll visit. Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 were also in mare areas of varying ages, and this one may be even younger yet.
And then possibly a volcanic crater or two.
Volcanic complex to the north, which we'll be visiting hopefully on the third EVA.
Well, will Apollo 16 and 17 be equally as ambitious from a scientific viewpoint, do you think?
I believe that the scientific objectives will be every bit as important. I don't believe that we'll probably ever visit again during the Apollo series as spectacular a site as Hadley Apennine. I think that the viewers at home who will be able to see this on television will see some very, very spectacular views of the moon.
There's almost no place on Earth that can compare with the mountain altitude from the landing site. Picture, if you will, you're landing in a flat plain, and then within 3 kilometers, 3 to 6 kilometers, there is this great mountain escarpment going up some 5,000 meters. There's just no place on Earth where you get that visual impression, is there?
I don't know of any area on Earth where you can stand in one point and look at the top of a mountain which is 5,000 meters high within a very short distance.
There are taller mountains on Earth, but you don't get to see them with such clarity.
That's right. The difference in relief is normally much less than that. As an example, Pikes Peak in Colorado is over 14,000 feet high, but you're looking at it from Colorado Springs or Denver from an altitude of 5,000 to 6,000 feet, so the differential is only about 9,000 feet.
Uh-huh. Well, Don, you know, I talked to Don Beatty. Thank you very much for giving us this review of the objectives of the mission. You know, I talked to Dave Scott before they launched, and Dave has a very keen sense of the historical impact and sense of the history he's making here. And I ask him these questions about it. Let's hear this recorded voice of Dave Scott before the launch. Dave, as I think I've mentioned on the air before, you impressed me with a particularly keen sense of history on what's being accomplished in the Apollo program, and you certainly are aware of the possible scientific benefits and discoveries to be made on your flight. Let's talk about that and how you feel about this whole moon exploration program.
Well, I think the only reason we have the capability to go and explore the moon is because many years ago, people had the same idea, and explorers set forth to seek scientific knowledge outside of their own environment.
You certainly have named your spacecraft after one of those, Captain
Yes.
Cook's Endeavour,
we
the command module.
That James Cook, a little over 200 years ago, set out on the first purely scientific expedition by ship to Tahiti to witness to observe the transit of the planet Venus, and to subsequently explore the South Pacific. And he was on a purely scientific voyage for the first time, and our Command and Service Module is going on a purely scientific voyage for the first time, carrying the bay of scientific instruments. And so we felt there was a certain relationship there, and therefore we chose the name that Captain Cook chose, the Endeavour.
Now how do you feel about the overall impact of the Apollo discoveries? You think it's really going to take years and years for mankind to really absorb the significance of what you're doing right now?
Well, it'll take years and years to reduce all the data, and that's for sure, because of the magnitude of data recorded on this flight. And the samples brought back, many of them will not be investigated for years. They put them away for a decade to let the next decade of scientists look at something fresh and new. And we feel that understanding the moon is much like understanding Australia in the days of James Cook. It was unknown. There were many very significant and wonderful things there. And I'm sure that in the years to come, the scientific community, having the opportunity to analyze the data we gather around and on the surface of the moon, will come to some very profound conclusions about the formation of the moon, the Earth, and the solar system.
That's something in which you take pride as you're doing this, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. I think that in order to propagate mankind and enable man to continue on his growth and his development on the Earth and maintain his livability on the Earth, he has to explore and he has to reach out. And we're reaching now to a realm which was unheard of 200 or 300 years ago.
Thanks very much, Dave Scott, and we'll be listening and following very carefully everything you're doing there on the surface of the moon during Apollo 15.
Thank you, Ed.
David Scott, commander of Apollo 15.
You talk about a man who's reaching out right now. He's reaching out a long way, isn't he, Don? That's the commander of this mission, and there you get just a bit of an insight into what he thinks about the overall effort he's undertaking now in conducting America's fourth lunar exploration mission. Don Beatty, want to thank you very much for being with us here, and I hope maybe that as you're in Houston in that science support room, we may have the chance to bring you in on our air again also.
Thank you, Red. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, and good luck on conduct of that lunar surface operation, which you will be concerned with. Well, Apollo 15 has gone out of range of signals here on Earth. It's passed over the Canary Islands, and in about 30 minutes from now, they will be in communication range with a tracking station at Carnarvon, Australia. We'll be reporting that translunar injection in about 2 hours from now. This is Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy.
We come to the end of the Voice of America's first live broadcast in our coverage of the flight of Apollo 15, man's fourth journey to the lunar surface. The spacecraft left its Cape Kennedy launch pad at 13 hours 34 GMT and is now in an Earth parking orbit 25 minutes into the mission. A couple of hours from now, a go-no-go decision on translunar insertion will be made. A decision whether or not to fire the rocket engine that will push Apollo 15 out of the pull of the Earth's gravity and on its way to the moon. The Voice of America's next worldwide broadcast will come on Friday, July 30th, at 22 hours GMT. This is the point in the mission when Commander David Scott and James B. Irwin maneuver their Lunar Module Falcon in descent over the Apennine Peaks to a landing spot near the rim of the moon's canyon-like Hadley Rill. The Voice of America will bring you live coverage of the main events of Apollo 15. And our regular broadcasts will report fully on the progress of the mission. My thanks to VOA space correspondent Rhett Turner and Don Beatty of the National Aeronautics and Space Agency at Cape Kennedy. This is Norman Garron at the Apollo News Center in Washington. This program has come to you from the United States of America.